Hello, and welcome to the Badger Talks podcast, the podcast that shares interviews with experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison community about their work, research, and a little bit about what they're like as people, too. I'm your host, Buzz Kemper. Today, we're focusing on Brood 13, the 17-year emergence of cicadas in southern Wisconsin, and I'm happy to have as my guest P.J. Leash, whose official title is Director of UW-Madison's Insect Diagnostic Lab, and his unofficial title is the Wisconsin Bug Guy. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Buzz.
So this fascinates me. There's so many things I want to ask you about this cicada emergence. The first thing I think I want to start with, because you're a scientist, is it seems to me that, you know, everything in the natural world has some kind of reason for being or for happening. You know, why is this happening? And the answer usually has something to do with spreading the genes, right? It's genetics. It's like, how do we procreate? How do we make more of this thing? And whether it's humans or plants, what if we know the answer to this, which maybe we don't, genetic or evolutionary purpose, does a 17-year cycle serve?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting topic to think about, and scientists have wondered about it for a long time. And there's some different ideas that have been put out there, but to a certain extent, we don't know the exact reason for this. But you can make the case that the 17-year life cycle and some of their patterns, like these emergences in huge, tremendous numbers, evolutionary speaking, that could be advantageous in a couple ways. First off, if you are an insect or any creature that comes out on a very regular basis, every year, every other year, whatever eats you is probably going to catch on to that. So cicadas, plenty of vertebrates feed on them, birds, mammals, turtles, things like that. And so if mammals, you know, some of our mammals have a lifespan of a couple years, and they could catch on to that. And you might start seeing population cycles. They could almost, in a way, anticipate, hey, this big food source is coming next year.
Yeah.
But if you come out at these long time intervals, and some of these periodical cicadas, it's 13 years, most of them are 17 years, most vertebrates are not that long-lived to be able to remember that or take advantage of
right.
it. So by having these long life cycles, that might help you out in that your predators can't catch on, anticipate that, and wipe you all out.
Okay.
Another aspect of this, though, is when these periodical cicadas emerge, they come out in just huge numbers. So we see some cicadas every year, but it's usually one here, one there, relatively enormous. But these things come out on the order of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or more per acre. And
yeah.
So there's plenty to go around, so to speak. Some of those are going to be eaten right off the bat, and the adults themselves are clumsy. They just kind of clumsily walk around, maybe fly a little bit. So lots and lots of them are eaten, but okay. due to the sheer numbers, there's plenty that are going to survive, while the predators, their tummies are full, essentially. They can't eat all of
them.
Yeah,
I've eaten all the cicadas I can eat, and there are still 10 million more.
Exactly.
When you say they're awkward and clumsy, is that upon emergence, or is that their whole life cycle they are awkward and clumsy?
Yeah, upon their emergence as adults. And
okay.
When you think of their life cycle, they're really underground for 99-ish percent of their life cycle.
Yeah.
Close to 17 years, and then they come out, and the adults are out for a matter of a few weeks, maybe a month or so. So they're not terribly long-lived as adults. It's most of their time is just below ground. They live in these little tunnels. They drink sap from tree roots, and that's what they do for most of their life.
So once they emerge, their life cycle is, their lifespan is only weeks?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
As adults, I mean, they do most of their feeding, their growth and development underground. When they come out, really what's on their mind is finding a mate.
Yeah.
And so that month that they're out, that's all for the most part that they're trying to do is find a mate,
yeah.
reproduce so they can perpetuate their species.
That's so funny. I mean, it's like, yeah, we must perpetuate the species. We must procreate. And my children will enjoy 17 years of living in a tunnel underground and then have come out and have a real life in the real world for like 6 weeks or whatever. Yeah. How many weeks is it approximately?
Well, for the adults, it can depend. If you pop out and you're eaten 2 minutes later,
right,
that's it.
Right.
In general, though, it's going to be on the range of weeks. Okay. I tell folks roughly a month or so for the adult lifespan.
Okay. Wow, that is really interesting. This is called Brood 13, is that correct? Okay. How many broods are there? Are there 13, or do the numbers skip around? And let's talk about the differences between these different broods.
Yeah, so there's actually a whole bunch of different broods. Most of these are 17-year cicadas. There's three broods that are 13-year cicadas, and we don't have any of those in Wisconsin. We just have one single brood of 13-year cicadas here. One single brood of 17-year cicadas, and that happens to be brood 13. So it's interesting, if you look into the history of these insects, folks have started documenting their presence in written records going all the way back to the 1600s. Once Europeans came over and they'd see them in New England and places like that, said, what are these weird insects? And over time, folks have tried to categorize them, and there's been different numbering systems, but our current numbering system came about in the early 1900s.
Okay.
And so if you dig in old literature, what we call brood 13 was previously numbered differently, and it gets a little confusing in the old literature.
Okay, all right. We don't have to get too far into the weeds on that, but are there broods 1 through 12 as well?
Yeah, and when you look at a list of all the broods, there are some gaps. There's some broods that we knew of previously that seem to have gone extinct, but basically when they started numbering these broods, it was simply based on what year they emerged in.
Okay.
And so it's a sequence. And if you look at all the Roman numerals, it goes up higher than the actual number of existing broods today because there's some gaps in the record.
Okay. But
this year, we've got brood 13, northern Illinois and parts of southern Wisconsin. And then to the south of that, brood 19, which are some 13-year periodical cicadas. So I'm throwing a lot of numbers around here.
Yeah, no, that's all right. When we're talking about these different broods of cicadas, is the only difference the emergence cycle, or are there other differences too? Are some larger or smaller? What other differences are there, or are we only talking about the emergence cycle?
For the most part, it's the emergence cycle. So
each
of the different number broods will be emerging in essentially a different year. So for the 17-year cicadas, a brood 10 and a brood 13 will never emerge in the same year because they are set for the years. And you can go online and find tables that tell you 200 years from now, what brood is coming out when.
Yeah,
it's basically when those broods emerge. There are some technical differences. So for our 17-year periodical cicadas, there's actually three different species. Mm-hmm. For our 13-year cicadas, there's actually four different species.
Oh,
now, to you and I, just looking at them, they're going to look pretty similar. There's some technical ways you can tell them apart. But for Wisconsin, at least, I spent some time recently in the Wisconsin Insect Research Collection. That's our collection on campus, millions of specimens. And we've got close to 100 specimens of these cicadas in the collection. All of them from Wisconsin were a single species, so that's going to be our commonest one. Maybe the other one or two could pop up potentially, but it happens to be the species Magia cicada septendecim.
So the primary difference is that emergence cycle. How many different emergence cycles are there? So we know there's a 17, we know there's a 13. Are there others?
For periodical cicadas that we're talking about, there's really only the 17 or the 13-year cycles. We've got other cicadas in general in Wisconsin elsewhere, but those are what we call our annual cicadas because we see some of them each year.
If you took an annual cicada and set it next to a 17-year cicada, would we see differences, or are there differences that maybe we don't see but they are there?
There's going to be some big differences right off the bat.
Okay.
So our commonest cicadas that you and I hear, everyone in the state pretty much hears in July and August, we call those our dog day cicadas. Those are fairly large insects, let's say about an inch and a half long. They are blackish with olive green. They've got clear wings. They've got dark eyes. And they're pretty thick, robust insects. And most folks, I feel, would probably recognize that at least as a cicada. In contrast, our periodical cicadas, they're often a little bit smaller, and it depends on the exact species, but probably a little bit smaller. Their coloration is very different. They are black with some orangish color on the body and on their legs. And also with those, the eyes are a very distinctive red color on these periodical cicadas. If you had them side by side, anyone would really be able to look at those and say, those are two different creatures just based on the appearance.
Okay. So the annuals have black eyes and the 17-year have red eyes.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that we hear them, you know, in these dog days of summer, and boy, do we ever. I always feel a little bit bad for the APT, the American Players Theater actors, when they are doing their late summer performances. And the actors in the outdoor theater have to act but shout over the almost deafening sound sometimes of these bugs. What is the purpose of the sound? What can you tell me about how is the sound made? What is the sound's purpose?
Yeah, so the purpose is simple. It's finding a mate.
Okay.
And so for the most part, this is the males that are, in a way, screaming or yelling to try and attract the females. Hey, okay. I'm over here. Let's get together. In terms of how they do this,
I'm glad humans don't do that. That would be really irritating.
It'd be pretty loud in the singles bar, you know. In terms of how this works, though, so on the male periodical cicadas, and this is pretty cool, you know, as someone who works with sound and acoustics and all this.
Yeah.
So the male cicadas, their abdomen is actually pretty hollow. Okay. So you have this kind of echo chamber, if you will, for vibrations. On the side of their abdomen, they have these two structures called timbals, and it's basically like the membrane on a snare drum, and there's muscles attached to it. So you can have these very rapid contractions of the muscles. It's causing deformations in that membrane, and it's vibrating back and forth. That is how it produces a sound. And then again, their hollow abdomen is allowing these sounds to resonate, and so that's going to help with it as well.
Okay. So the sound is happening internally inside their abdomen?
Yeah, that's an aspect of it. And then, of course, we hear the sound as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always thought, you know, of course, I'm not an entomologist, but I always assumed that the sound was being produced outside of the body, that either it was their legs rubbing against something or some kind of a vocalization, and that's why it's so loud. The fact that it's happening internally and it's still that loud, boy, that little cicada is vibrating like crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's really mind-boggling when you think of this creature that's maybe an inch or just over an inch long, and they've got these membranes and they can vibrate to produce sound of that loudness. I mean, if you are near a cicada hotspot, the sound levels can be on the order of 70, 80 decibels, so it might be, you know, kind of close to a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
If you're really close, so it can be higher. It can be 90 plus decibels potentially. So really, really loud for such a tiny creature.
Yeah. A lot of amplified music concerts are in the mid to high 90s in terms of sound pressure levels. So that gives people kind of an idea of what we're talking about. What is the rest of the mating cycle then? If the males are making the sound, does that mean that the females come to them following the sound? And how does the female, when there are a zillion of these things happening, is there a particular tone that the female is attracted to? We know that some animals, the males are very colorful, and so that is what attracts the female. Yeah, how does this whole thing work in terms of the male and the female actually getting together?
Yes, you've got the male calling, producing all this noise, and keep in mind, if you're in a cicada hotspot, there's lots of this going on.
So
thousands of males, thousands of females. A female can approach, and if she is receptive to the male sound, she likes the sound of it, she can do basically a snap of her wings, and that can make a little kind of clicking noise.
Okay.
And then they may approach a little bit closer. The male may be calling back to her. If she likes it, she may snap her wings again, make this little clicking noise, and then they eventually get close enough to mate.
Okay.
There's a really cool video of this online, though. It was one of the BBC shows with David Attenborough, where he has found a male periodical cicada that's singing, and he is snapping his finger to mimic the female's wing flick. And so the male is responding to this
and
ends up jumping on his hair and buzzing right in his ear, which has just got to be you know, ungodly loud.
Yeah.
But he could he could get the male to follow the click of his fingers, and then he could move his hand the other direction, snapping in and get the poor male to turn around. The male's confused, thinking this female's moving around. It's just David Attenborough.
Yeah, right. His fingers. Oh man, that's kind of mean, but you know, but it's very instructive. What about the cicadas in terms of their position in the food chain? You said that, you know, they emerge, some of them are eaten right away, a lot of them survive. The fact that there are so many of them all at once seems to me counterintuitive in terms of the food chain. You know, if you're an animal that eats these things, you would rather have a steady supply of a reasonable number of them rather than 17 years of nothing and then suddenly enough food for seven lifetimes. Is there anything you can enlighten us about that? Does any of this make sense, or is it just a puzzle of nature?
Yeah, I mean, the way I think of it more is, and we talked about this a little bit, because of the long life cycles, vertebrates aren't really able to anticipate this. So
right.
They're still having to collect their usual food, go about their business.
Yeah.
But if I'm, say, a skunk or a raccoon, this is just a free smorgasbord that pops out. It's a temporary thing for about a month, but I'm going to gorge myself as much as I can on this free food while it lasts.
Yeah, right. It's amazing. And you said turtles eat them as well.
Yeah, I've seen some video clips. If you have an emergence near a pond or a lake or a stream, and these cicadas are clumsy, so if some fall into the water, they're easy pickings for fish, for turtles, for anything else in there that might be big enough to chow down on them.
Oh, wow. Interesting. I was going to say, if a turtle is going after them on land, that implies that the cicadas must be very slow or awkward if you can't outrun a turtle.
Yeah. I mean, anytime these pop out in the news around the U.S. for different life cycles, there's usually some articles along the lines of, you know, is it okay if my dog eats these? Because that's going to be a common thing.
Right.
I've heard of that in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And again, these insects as adults are just really pretty clumsy. They just kind of walk around slowly. And so they're really easy pickings for vertebrates.
But they can fly, right?
They can. They're not strong flyers.
Okay.
And when they emerge from a given spot, and this is a really important thing to know about these insects, is they're very localized.
Okay.
So even though some of the maps make it look like they're widespread across southern Wisconsin, it's really individual pins on a map, so to speak. So
okay.
They pop out from their given grove of trees or in a fruit orchard or something like that, and they really don't disperse very far from that.
They stay pretty local. I don't know if this is a fair question of an entomologist, but I assume that you probably know some amazing stories about, you know, somebody coming out of their house and suddenly, you know, like they've got a 2-inch thick pile and they have to shovel them, or do you have a cicada emergence story?
You know, I've heard anecdotes.
Okay.
It's interesting. I'm just shy of 40 years old, and this will be the first year that I've ever seen these with my own eyes. I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin in Racine County, but east of where they really occur. So I missed them as a kid in 1990. I missed them in 2007. That was a year I moved from southeastern Wisconsin to come to Madison for graduate school.
Okay.
I missed him that year. So this is going to be my first chance to really see him. I've heard the stories of folks having to take a snow shovel to clear their sidewalk and things like that. I've heard of folks trying to have outdoor activities. You know, if you're planning an outdoor wedding and it happens to be in a cicada hotspot, there could be some conflicts there between the acoustics.
You will have a lot more guests at your wedding than you had intended.
Uninvited ones, yes.
Is there anything that you would like people to know or that you think would be interesting to know about cicadas and about this emergence for which I haven't asked the right question? Anything you'd like to add in?
Well, a couple things come to mind. The first is that sometimes folks, when they think about insects, a common question that comes to mind is good or bad? And to me,
right. It
seems a little silly. As an entomologist, I think sometimes, what if we walk down the street and ask, is that person good or bad? Is that one good or bad? It would be kind of silly to do that. For the most part, though, these cicadas are really quite harmless.
Right.
They don't bite. They don't have a stinger or anything like that. They might be a little bit of a nuisance.
There's no venom. Right.
Exactly. looking at the bigger picture, they're food for wildlife.
Yeah.
That's going to be great for them. Wouldn't surprise me if bird populations and mammal populations were up because of that in some areas. Can they do a little bit of damage? They technically can when the females go to lay eggs. She's got a structure called an ovipositor. It looks like a spear. And so she takes this from her abdomen and uses it to cut slits into twigs on trees, and she inserts her eggs into there. And so if you've got, I mean, imagine if you took a pocket knife and just cut a bunch of slits into a tree, those twigs might die and break off.
Right.
For big trees, you know, if you've got a 30, 40, 50 foot tall tree, they tolerate it just fine. It might be noticeable and conspicuous, but the trees do just fine.
Okay.
If you had, say, a recently planted tree, then you could lose a greater percentage of the canopy. And what I tell folks in a case like that is get some fine mesh netting or screening, cover the tree. You only have to do it for about a month while the cicadas are out. Another really cool thing I want to mention about this, and I alluded to this a little bit, that personally, this is the first time I'm going to see these. It kind of, in my mind, is in that same realm of and we've got one coming up, the eclipse.
You know, yes.
How many times in your life do you get to experience some of these things?
Right.
And for the average human lifespan, you know, for Wisconsinites, you might only have, say, 4-5-ish times in your entire life to see these insects here in the Badger State. So this is something really unique, really cool. And after this year, you know, we've got to wait 17 more years before they're going to be back.
Right, right. So if someone wants to witness this, and I'm sure it's hard to see the actual emergence because you'd have to be there at the exact moment, but if you just want to see the populations and just the, you know, just the sort of cacophony of it, where are the best, because you said that these are kind of pinpoints, where are the best places to go?
Yeah, that's a great question. And part of it is we still don't have the complete picture of where they are because old records were just listed a county for where they were. Think of Dane County, how many square miles it is.
Right, yeah, right.
You can have a little population in one corner of the county and not see them anywhere else, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
In Dane County, we know there's some activity in Mazamani that's documented. I've had a report from Deerfield. I'm not sure the population status there. But if you really want to see these, the best place to go that comes up again and again in records is the Lake Geneva area.
Okay.
They seem to have a strong, robust population there, and the time to go is important. Our dog day cicadas, I mentioned, that we hear in dog days of summer, July, August, those are much later than these. Periodical cicadas are in spring. So depends a little bit on the weather and temperature. And a key signal for emergence is ground or soil temperature at a depth of 8 inches.
Okay.
Once we get up to about 64, 64 and a half degrees, then they start popping out. So it'll be a little while yet, but historically, looking at 1990, 2007, they probably are popping out in late May, really the month of June is that's when to see it. So Lake Geneva in the month of June, if you want to see and experience this, I know there's like Bigfoot Beach State Park and some other areas.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Okay. I would love to see that. Do they start buzzing right away? Or is it later on in the mating season?
It's a little bit later on.
Okay.
So once they emerge, first they have to emerge. They're still juveniles or nymphs at that point. Yeah. They molt, so they'll latch onto a tree trunk or a fence post. Uh-huh. They basically shed their skin. Once the adult is out, it's usually a couple of days before they start calling.
Okay, cool. I rock climb a lot at Devil's Lake, and it's not uncommon to see those skins just sitting there. And you think you're seeing a cicada, and then you walk up and you realize it's just, is it an exoskeleton?
Exoskeleton, yes.
Okay, wow. And then I just want to know a little bit about you. Did young PJ say, I want to grow up to be an entomologist? And I also want to know, what do you do when you're not studying bugs? What are your hobbies, outside interests?
Yeah, so as a kid, I grew up in rural southeastern Wisconsin, not on a farm, but next to a dairy farm. But we had a lot of kind of wildlife areas around us. There is a wetland area half a mile behind her house. Across the street, though, was this exotic animal farm. So as a kid, I'd open my bedroom window every morning and I see camels or a zebra or something like that. And so I always grew up with this.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. We'd be playing outside as kids in the summer and you'd hear the lion across the street roaring. So I always grew up with this fascination of animals. In high school, I fell in love with biology in particular. And so I knew when I started college from day one, I was going to be a biology major, and I never changed course. Right around my junior college is when we started hearing about this insect called the emerald ash borer.
Oh, yes.
Now is wreaking havoc in the state. It wasn't here yet. And I got linked up and connected with a professor here at UW-Madison, and I did some surveys in parts of Wisconsin looking at thousands of ash trees to see is there any indication that insect might be present. Didn't find it at the time. That got my foot in the door, and that was really when I said, I love insects and entomology. I was always generally interested in insects, but that was the point, and I jokingly tell folks, emerald ash borer was my gateway bug.
It
really solidified that. I went on for grad school, worked for a couple years as a researcher, and then I've been running the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab for 10 years at this point.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you for half an hour just about the emerald ash borer, but we'll have to save that for another time. And then what do you do for fun?
Well, these days, when I have some free time, because I've got two young kids, three and under, so I'm pretty busy with that.
I've heard children take time.
They do. I enjoy running. Yeah. When I have time to get out on trail runs, that's great, especially when you can just feel like you're cruising and flying on the trail.
Yeah.
Mountain biking, lots of outdoor stuff. My family likes to go up to the North Woods. We've got some land up there and a family cabin. So spending time out on the water, hiking, those sorts of things.
Okay, terrific. PJ Leash, director of UW-Madison's Insect Diagnostic Lab. Yeah, just really, really interesting stuff. These emergences, they're always something that when they're about to happen or when they have just happened, they bring up a ton of questions and areas of fascination about what is this all about. And you have really shed some light on a lot of the aspects of these emergences. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Director of UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, PJ Leash. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you. The Badger Talks podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studio in Madison, Wisconsin. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.